Yeah, as we continue in our topic of series, I want to consider something that I don't know if you've ever come across it or been engaged in debate about it, but pictures of Jesus. I know when the Passion came out, it was lots of debate in the Reformed camp with respect to would it be immoral to go and see that movie because there's somebody acting as Jesus Christ. So the second commandment says, you shall not make for yourself a carved image, any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or that is on the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them nor serve them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me. So there's many Christians who I know who will not watch either that Jesus movie. There was a famous one made on Luke's gospel that was very true to the biblical text. It was kind of word for word in the biblical text, but because Christ was portrayed and depicted in the movie, they wouldn't watch it. Also, Bibles, you get children's Bibles sometimes with some pictures in them. And if they have pictures of Jesus, once again, those would be strongly denounced by many folk. So it's important to understand what the second commandment is referring to. We need to answer that question, is it moral or immoral to look at a picture of Jesus? It's, obviously, it's not it's an artist's impression. There are many who would say that this is a clear violation of the second commandment. So a kid's Bible would be a violation of the commandment. Now the second commandment is very clear on what it says. No image of anything. But the image was for a purpose. What was the purpose of that image? And that was, what is the verse trying to teach us, I believe, the second commandment. And the context, I believe, is obvious. It's showing us that it's forbidden any kind of image made for the purpose of worshipping God. So it's for worshipping, trying to depict and capture God and His glory and His immenseness or whatever it is. An image obviously fails to do that. But is the commandment against art? Is it against a sculpture? Like with the sixth commandment, we have to look carefully at what the words mean for us in this life, because the sixth commandment doesn't forbid capital punishment, although it speaks about not killing. Now, people are made in the image of God, but that doesn't mean we can worship people. So the second commandment forbids using images for the purpose of worship. And the reason for this is because we should only worship God, and it's impossible to capture or represent God with an image, whether mental or physical. However, when it comes to art, history, or instruction, we cannot be so dogmatic, I believe. The Bible doesn't forbid art like drawing, sculpture, engraving. I mean, in the tabernacle you had engravings and embroideries and stuff. It's especially for the purpose of worship that no images are to be used. As Calvin said in his Institutes, I'm not gripped by the superstition of thinking absolutely no image is permissible. But because sculpture and painting are gifts of God, I see a pure and legitimate use of each, lest those things which the Lord has conferred upon us for His glory and our good be not polluted by perverse misuse, but also turned to our destruction. Okay, so we've got to be careful with the art, we've got to be careful with what we're using it for, what it's being designed for. But the second commandment could, in one sense, say no image of anything can be ever made. So it kind of sounds like. So Calvin is saying, no, that's not what it's saying. What about lecturers? I know Cornelius Van Til would always draw a big circle on the board for God, and a little circle for everything else. And the authority was God was over all. He was the ultimate. And so would that be depicting an image? Is that making an image of God, because you're using it for, you know, instruction purposes? Would that be something that is in violation of the second commandment? Is the triquetra, do you know what that is? Those three, what's not three, it's really one, but it's like those three-pointed interlacing where there's no beginning and no end. It's a symbol that's been used historically in a number of different, from pagan to Christian contexts, but it's kind of often used as a depiction of the Trinity, where you've got these three in one. Obviously it's not a good depiction, but I mean, is that just, you know, is that kind of a blasphemy? Is that a violation of the second commandment? So I know you can often see it around. Jesus is unique. Okay, he's a unique person. And for the sake of true theology, this issue must be considered very carefully, because he's both perfect God and perfect man. And when his disciples looked at him, at the image of the perfect man, beholding, looking into his eyes, looking into his face, were they in violation of some image? When they thought about him, when they were away from him, they had some image, some picture in their mind of who he was. The Lord said to Moses, "You cannot see my face, for no man shall see me and live." Exodus 33 verse 20. And the fact that God said this and then many, many people looked upon Jesus and lived has to make us cautious about jumping to a conclusion about, well, what is the legitimacy of Christ's position? Some would say that those who make pictures of Jesus' humanity are Nestorians. Nestorius was a theologian who lived around 428 AD. And he's thought to have separated or divided the two natures of Christ, saying Christ was made up of two persons, one human and one divine. So these two persons were kind of in the same situation. There's doubt whether Nestorius actually taught that, but anyway, this heresy got labeled with his name for all his efforts. So it's known as Nestorianism. So kind of the natures of Christ, in trying to protect the respective natures of Christ by completely separating them, by making two persons rather than having two natures in one person. This is, you know, sometimes you can hear theologians debating down to these points, and you get into that, well, the nature of Christ. And we know in the early church there was great debates as to, well, who was Christ and what was his nature, true nature, like. And those are not just irrelevant theological points, because there are ramifications and implications when our theology is bad. We misunderstand who Christ is, for example. The Chalcedonian definition of the person of Jesus Christ states that Christ has two natures. And this, the reason they came out with the Chalcedonian declaration was because of this confusion that existed at the time with respect to the natures of Christ. So it says he has two natures, but he's only one person. And so we get into mystery there from our perspective, and as far as our ability to understand properly, we don't know where all the lines are and where one begins and one ends. So we state the doctrine and we hold to that, although we can't explain. If somebody could ask us many questions, that we would be, I'm not quite sure how that would fit together. So the humanity and the deity of Christ exist without confusion, that's what Chalcedon says, without confusion, without change, without division, without separation. So they're emphasizing this point, that absolutely the natures are there, but they're not divided. The humanity of Christ is not. There's an unchangeable union between the human and the divine natures of Christ, though to remain true to their nature, they have to be kept both complete and distinct, true divinity and true humanity, with neither adding to nor subtracting from the other. Chalcedon says, without confusion, without change, true humanity in all its fullness and absolute completion, as we know humanity, together with the absolute divinity and the fullness of the Godhead, is joined in one person, without the humanity detracting anything from the divinity, and the divinity blurring and diluting or changing anything in the humanity. How that works? Look at Jesus. We distinguish between Christ's natures, though we don't divide or separate them. When we say Christ died on the cross, we distinguish between his two natures. His divine nature did not die. Did Jesus die? Yes, absolutely. But when you start to get theological, you say, well, what about his divine nature? His divine nature could not die. When we say Mary was the God-bearer, we distinguish between the natures. Christ's humanity had a beginning. His divinity didn't. Likewise, we don't say that God the Father shed his blood for our sins. We distinguish between the persons of the Trinity without separating them. We have the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. And when we distinguish between them, we're not separating them. This is an important point because those who would argue about Christ and depictions, having depictions of him, they try and force that argument. We'll get to that in a bit. As Calvin argues, we have to distinguish between inseparable things, for if we don't make a distinction, we'll end up blurring the two into one. Now, Christ reconciled us to the Father in his flesh, though he had to be God to accomplish this. Nevertheless, we have to emphasize the fact that Christ was not made righteous, was not made righteousness for us with respect to his divine nature. And Calvin goes to some depths arguing against somebody in his day who was arguing that it was the divine nature that through which we get the righteousness. And he said, this is devastating. It's terrible theology to do that. It's in Christ's human nature that secures our righteousness, as 1 Corinthians 1:30 says. And fundamentally, that's what Calvin's standing on. And then he'll reason why. But fundamentally, that's what the scriptures say. So that's where he's standing. We also make a distinction between Christ's divinity and his humanity in his exalted state. Where is Jesus? Sitting at the right hand of power. So does that mean he's not with us on earth? No, he's very much with us on earth. So is his humanity, is his human nature omnipresent? Is it everywhere? No, it's in heaven only. So we're making a distinction between his human and his divine natures without separating them, without destroying them. So when we say his human body remains in heaven at the right hand of the Father and that his divine nature is omnipresent, we haven't separated his natures. We've rather distinguished between them and stated what is appropriate and possible and legitimate for each one. To distinguish between Christ's natures and seek to understand what's possible and appropriate for each nature is not separating his natures. So to say that it is blasphemy to make a picture of Christ's humanity is to confuse and blur his humanity with his divinity. You see, when Christ was on the earth, there was no confusion with respect to his nature. His human nature was human, completely and utterly. He didn't stand out in the crowd with respect to his human nature. They'd say, "Whoa, this guy's got some kind of look or some aspect of divinity." Isaiah clearly tells us, Isaiah 53:2, that he was no different from any other person, as far as just from a purely human level. It is poor theology that leads to poor art. So when Jesus is pictured as having an unnatural glow or radiance or halo around his head, now that's poor theology that is now depicted in a picture that is wrong. When Jesus is pictured as having this unnatural glow, this is not depicting his true humanity. It's calling that into question, and it's clearly wrong because it's theologically erroneous. Jesus had a body like any other person when he tabernacled on the earth, truly human with all the physical appearance that go along with being human. And God intended that when someone looked upon Jesus, they saw his humanity, not his divinity. So they beheld his humanity, and that's what they saw. Talking about, is it a violation of the second commandment for you to have pictures of Jesus, whether in a movie or whether in a book? So as Calvin comments, he says, "For even though he emptied himself," quoting Philippians 2:7, "Jesus lost not his glory with the Father, which was hidden to the world." Calvin also said that Christ took the image of a servant and allowed his divinity to be hidden by a veil of flesh. And what does Philippians 2:8 mean? Save that for a time the divine glory did not shine, but only human likeness was a manifest in a lowly and abased condition. So Christ's divinity was not separated from him, it was just hidden within the veil of his flesh. If we say that in order for the humanity of Jesus to be true to reality, it had to be divine, we are making nonsense of the doctrine of Christ. But if we say that it is blasphemy to have pictures of Jesus, that is what we are saying. See, because when you say, well, can I have a picture of Christ? They'll say, well, is he God? And you say, yes, he's God. You say, well, the second commandment clearly says you must make no image of God. And I'll say, well, I'm not making an image of God. I'm making an image of the humanity side of Christ. That's the picture, depicting his humanity. And they're saying, well, no, we can't do that because now you're separating his nature. So I'm not separating, I'm distinguishing. I'm identifying. So even as they distinguished, when Christ was on the earth, he was not separated, but you were distinguished between his humanity and his divinity. Christ's humanity veiled his divinity, but this didn't turn his humanity into something other than true humanity. And it is not immoral to look upon a picture of a person. The scriptures strongly argue that Jesus was a real man, not an apparition or some other kind of composition, not totally human and not totally divine. One of the first Christological heresies was Docetism, a heresy that said Christ only seemed or appeared to have flesh and blood and appeared to have a true human nature, but he didn't really have this. So the Docetics, that was their position. John says, by this you know the Spirit of God. Every spirit that comes, that confesses that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh is of God. And every spirit that does not confess that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh is not of God. That's 1 John 4:3-4. So does in the flesh refer to something other than true humanity? John was extremely anxious to convince those he was writing to that Jesus was truly human and didn't merely assume an appearance of being human. John said, that which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked upon and our hands have handled, concerning the word of life. We've touched, we've felt, we've seen, we've beheld him. 1 John 1:1. This is the Christ he wanted others to believe in. The eyewitnesses are vital to the whole biblical account of Christ. These images of the true Christ were captured in people's minds, and they remembered what he looked like long after he had ascended into heaven. Those disciples who had seen him, all those who witnessed him. When they thought about Jesus, they thought about what they remembered. It is impossible to argue that all images of the incarnate Christ are sinful, and if it wasn't sinful then, back then when people were beholding him, how do we make it sinful now? If no picture or image of the man Christ Jesus is allowed, then when the preacher says Jesus lifted up his head, what is the hearer meant to picture? He must say, I mustn't think of head. I can't have any image in my mind of any, because a human head is a violation of that commandment. What do I think about when he says, and Jesus on the cross, you know, they grabbed his hand and they nailed it to the cross, but just don't think of a hand because that would be a violation of the second commandment. Now, I'm pushing the point because that's where you're going. If you're standing telling me that I can't have a picture of Christ, I'm not sure how you can avoid that, because you're going to have some image in your mind. And the preacher says, hand is the good Christian to picture anything but a hand. Don't think hand. Try that. So if it's blasphemy to have any image of God, including Jesus Christ, I don't know how we get around any of those aspects of his life and his existence. So some people feel that it's only Jesus' face that shouldn't be shown in pictures. And so, you know, some would accept the point and say, okay, well, as long as it's behind, a shot from the back, or you see his foot, or his hand stretches out, and it's the hand and the person's touched and healed, they would be comfortable with that, as long as we don't see the face. The same principles apply there. Some try to escape this theological dilemma by saying that it is immoral to have pictures of Jesus because no one knows what he looked like. And even if we knew what he looked like, it would be impossible to depict him accurately with a picture. But what can a picture portray adequately? Any picture? Because why do people look at a photograph of themselves and say, oh no, that's not a good picture. It's not portraying me adequately. What does it portray adequately? It only gives a certain impression of what it's like. It cannot exhaustively reproduce the qualities that are there. So that's true for everything. It's an artistic expression. Surely as long as the artistic expression is truly representing that which it claims to be representing, then it's lawful. Christ is a man. So to use your artistic interpretation and present him as a woman is a lie. So you don't have that kind of artistic impression. But I can picture him with a varied complexion of skin. I can picture him with a varied hair color. I can picture him various sizes, builds, shape, those kinds of things that are not really detracting from the reality. The idea is Christ is in the story. There is a place for legitimate artistic expression in preaching. And you can paint up a picture with words, a graphic picture of a battle of Christ upon the cross and what that entailed and looked like as his bones and joints were dislocated and the flesh that was ripped so that you could see his bones through his gaping flesh. Now you're picturing images there, painting a picture, and you've got an image in your mind, which technically would have to contradict the second commandment by the way some people interpret it. Is it lawful to compose a symphony that portrays to the world what you feel about Christ? No, it's an artistic impression of grandeur and beauty and authority and power and love and mercy. And I say this is depicting images of what we understand the gospel to be proclaiming. So obviously, from the Christian perspective, the value of any artistic expression, whether in picture or film or music, depends upon how accurate it portrays the truth about Christ. But in principle, I do not believe it's immoral or wrong to create an artistic representation of Christ. However, to use such pictures for the purpose of worship is wrong. So when you're picturing Christ, when you're bowing before God, that's why we don't have distractions in the church with respect to images or stuff. I know the Roman Catholic Church believes and teaches that to have images and these pictures and stuff of different scenes, it helps people to get into the worship. When you see Christ there, you can identify him. And so they're looking at this image, and it's really only meant to help them, but they're worshipping him. When we worship and we're thinking about God and his glory and his might, there we don't have images. We don't have pictures. We don't know what that is like in a sense. We just have these words and these descriptions of his might and his power and his authority and his love, and our hearts rise up to that. And worship him and feed upon him on that, but we don't need images. So in our mind, we don't have a picture of Jesus in our mind when we're praying and think that that's who we're praying to. There are many historical people that we do not know what they look like, from biblical characters throughout all the historical. I mean, I don't know, do we know what William Wallace looked like? I get pictures, descriptions, sometimes there's drawings of what people look like. You know, so if we're going to say, well, if we don't know exactly what Jesus looked like, it'll be wrong to have a picture of him. You know, the apostles. So we shouldn't have any pictures of any biblical, even a picture of Jerusalem, the rocks, because we're not quite sure exactly how all the rocks fitted together. The Godhead was veiled by Christ's flesh, and it's impossible to capture the flesh. And it is possible to capture the flesh in a picture. Paul criticized the Athenians in Acts 17:29 for thinking that they were able to represent God's divine being with their images. It's not possible to deal with the fact that Jesus' contemporaries looked upon him and were not committing idolatry by saying, since we don't have a picture of Jesus, we cannot picture him today. They weren't committing idolatry, and since we don't have a perfect representation, we can't do that. It is the worship of an image that is forbidden, not the existence of an image. Jesus, after all, is the image of the invisible God, Colossians 1:15. Moreover, Christ's humanity was like everyone else's humanity. So if this argument is that we can only artistically depict or, for instruction purposes, film something that is an exact representation of the person or object depicted, and then to apply that consistently, we'll be very restricted to what we can do with respect to anything that can be depicted that we haven't already got a picture of or a movie made of. John tells us that much of what Jesus did was not recorded in the Bible. So we don't even have a full account of what he did, the full extent. We've got pieces, and we can represent those, we can portray them, we can make them known. So we don't want to... I believe the forbidding of having pictures of Christ's humanity is very inconsistent. It sends out a very wrong message to anybody. If you're doing a story, if you're presenting the story, I have no problem even with a children's Bible with Christ being there. I think it's worse to have a children's Bible and you've got the only person that's always missing is Jesus Christ. I think you're promoting deceitism. Was he really human? I think there's scope for that. To forbid the pictures shows a misunderstanding of his true humanity. He is our great high priest because he was truly human like us. He took upon himself human flesh that was just like ours, and he endured the limitations of the human body, the weaknesses and the struggles that the human body had, as Hebrews 4:15 tells us. Yet he is also God and able to save to the utmost those who come to him. And so I think it's important we keep that distinction in our thinking with respect to the humanity and the divinity, and not lump those two together as we're understanding the second commandment. So if you have not come across that, you sure will come across it at some point that you're speaking to, particularly in Reformed circles. And I can remember I was at a conference shortly after the time the Passion had just been launched. It was a Reformed conference, OPC church conference. So there were some really heated debates about whether somebody should see that movie or not. And the majority, obviously I didn't speak to you about it at the conference, but the majority of the discussions that I overheard and could pick up on it was no, you shouldn't. So, any comments or questions?
I think another danger to be watchful for, whether or not it crosses this boundary of worship, non-worship, moral, immoral in of itself, people tend to use pictures to emphasize an aspect of God, which usually means don't consider the other aspects of God. And that becomes a real problem. What you've done is you've put God in your box. You pander to the "I like to think of God as X" mentality, which is the same as saying I'm unwilling to accept God as Y mentality, even though he reveals himself that way.
I think our mind needs to keep floating through all the, his power, his might, his grace, his mercy, his truth. We might at one point need to be focusing in upon his mercy and appreciating his forgiveness and the fullness of his heart to forgive us and of what it means. So then we would maybe focus in on the mercy a bit more than the judgment, or the mercy a bit more than, say, his omniscience of whatever. But I think if our minds are always and only focusing upon mercy, I think we need to broaden it out and say, no, I've got to be picturing it all. Mm-hmm. All right, if there's no other comments, let's end off in prayer.